You probably know the Hits. Hits?
Those guys?
You probably know the Hits.
Agree.
So I know you're on the you know, you're on the tech side of this. I'm on the sales side, and yeah, I did drop the ball. But I will say you couldn't get my new computer to work. So right. I think we're both we have an offer right now.
Yeah, we're 0-2 right now.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, we're okay. 0-2. So I'm back on the old equipment, back on my bullshit.
Yeah.
And let's talk some music. Now I do have a problem here though.
Okay.
Doing a little research.
Okay.
We're going to talk about Elton John today.
Okay. Okay.
And in doing a little bit of research right beforehand, I discovered Elton John is gay.
Whoa.
And I am in Texas, and I don't know if it's even legal that we talk about this.
That's true. Welcome to the podcast, guys. This is, you probably know the Hits. Yeah. I'm Jason. That's Jeremy. He's in Texas. Sir. I am not.
Yeah.
And the topic today is Elton John.
Yeah. So Jason, since you're in the Northwest where they're more tolerant of things,
right.
I'm going to let you take the lead. So I'll go ahead and toss it over to you. You just kind of give me everything you know about Elton John.
I know that Elton John made the song Rocket Man.
Yes.
And some others. There was one you did today that is also in the movie Almost Famous, which I'm going to admit, aside from Lion King, is basically all of my exposure to Elton John, except for, okay. except for like, you know, there's some stuff I'm sure that's on the radio once in a while. You put about 4 or 5 tracks on the playlist that, you know, we're going to put on the playlist, the official playlist for the podcast, right? And I knew 2 or 3 of them. You know, I don't know the titles of them. There is one besides Rocket Man that's like really big, though, that I don't think you put on the list. I can't remember the title. Do you? You obviously avoided like Rocket Man. Is there another 1 or 2 of them you can think of that's like super mega hit?
That I did or did not put on
that
the
you
list.
Did not, but either way, I mean, really,
well, Tiny Dancer and Leave On. Tiny Dancer is what you would have heard in Almost Famous.
That's right. 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 Rocket Man is the other one you just hear on classic rock all the time. Okay. Yeah. So Tiny Dancer, I do know that one. I know Rocket Man. Like I said, I my exposure to him originally was, like all Gen Xers, on MTV. When they had Can You Feel the Love Tonight from the esteemed film Lion King by Disney Pictures.
Right.
And that's about the last I heard of him until you told me recently. You guys, was it January or February? You guys went and saw he has like sort of a, I don't know if it's a going away tour or not, but it sounded like it was an amazing Lifetime kind of show, right?
Yeah, so to fast forward to the end, he is on a tour right now that I believe is a very legitimate farewell tour.
Okay.
For a variety of reasons. I know bands say that, and it's, you always take it with a grain of salt, but he is like 74, 75 years old.
Right. That's what I was going to ask is, you know, when I think of classic rock, I always think that that just means 70s, right? But now that I'm listening to classic rock radio once in a while, they're playing stuff to the 90s and stuff. So is Elton John, is he 70s? Is he mid-60s? When was he a thing?
The 70s was certainly his heyday. He had a lot of success in the 80s as well.
Okay.
And then he had this resurgence in the 90s with the Disney stuff, which I didn't care for. But, I mean, if you're him and it's the 90s, I'm sure you're just over the moon to have, like, some massive hits and winning.
Sure.
I think he might have won, actually, like, some Oscars for best music in a movie.
Yeah.
Best soundtrack. And of course, he's just a staple as a live act. You know, I don't think he's played a show that wasn't completely sold out in 40 years.
Okay.
And this big farewell tour is once again kind of the same thing. I mean, he's playing all over the world, and it's the money we spent to go to that show. I do not even want to say it was ridiculous. And that was 2 nights. He played 2 nights in Dallas.
Yeah.
And it was still, he could have played 10 nights in Dallas and would have sold out every one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And now he's, you know, right now he's coming back in about a month, and he's going to play stadiums all over the U.S. and those are all sold out.
Before we get into it, though, is he one of those guys who knows what he's doing and, you know, is kind of once in a while he'll tour every few years up until now? Or is it he would tour every year kind of like Paul McCartney and just constantly sell out all the time?
Yeah, he's kind of like that. He's really? Kind of consistently toured. I actually saw him probably 15 years ago.
Okay.
And he's been pretty consistent. So it's not like he went away for a long time then had a big comeback.
Right. This isn't the Fleetwood Mac thing where it's like once a decade. Really?
No. He's pretty consistently been on the road. I mean, he headlined Bonnaroo a few years ago.
Okay.
I mean, the guy, there's no shortage of opportunities to see Elton John. And that's what's really amazing about the demand.
Right.
To see him. And we're seeing other classic rock acts where it's like that. The Eagles are like that. I mean, the Eagles tour all the time now, even after Glenn Frey died, like they still tour pretty much nonstop.
Sure.
And every time they come through Dallas, I always check tickets and they're like $500 minimum on the resale market.
Man,
you can't get in.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's he's been on the road consistently since 1970.
Jeez, I mean, man, what a
without any significant breaks
in 72, no doubt. And been set for life. And here
what is wrong with this dude? His appeal is really all over the world. It's not like he's big in America or big in England. I mean, he is massive worldwide.
Right.
And he says he really loves performing. He loves it. He still loves it to this day. He said the moment where the lights go down and the intro music starts and I walk out on stage and I hear the crowd is still at age 75, like the best thing in the world.
Okay.
But he's also now married. He has two children. And he's like, I'm going to be dying on stage while my kids are teenagers if I keep doing this.
Yeah, right.
And I can't do it.
Right.
So he's decided to step away. And I think he's got shows scheduled through 2023. And he said that's it.
There'll be
no more tours. He hasn't ruled out doing some one-off shows, a charity show or something. But it wouldn't surprise me to see him set up shop in Las Vegas or something.
Right.
And do something there where you can kind of, you know, you can have your family and you're in one place for a long time.
Right.
Wouldn't shock me. Or wouldn't shock me to see him do something like Billy Joel does at Madison Square Garden, where he plays Madison Square Garden once a month.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what Billy Joel does. You know, if Elton John wanted to play the O2 Arena in London once a month, he could do that for as long as he wanted to. Yeah. He'd sell out every show. No 100%. Problem.
Yeah.
So let's go back.
So man, this guy is a lot bigger than I thought. Like, I know, like I said, of Tiny Dancer and Rocket Man. Those are like the staples you'll hear on classic rock all the time, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I was thinking it was the Eagles is one you just mentioned, you know, somebody who, yeah, they can sell stuff out now 100%, but it's kind of somebody who maybe paused through all the 80s, 90s, early 2010s and is just having like a, you know, reunion, for lack of a better word. I know it's just him, but you know what I mean? I had no idea he was this big. So yeah, I mean, let's start. Who is Elton John?
Elton John is actually named Reginald Dwight.
Okay.
That's where I was born. That's how he was born.
Okay.
He was born to, tell me if you've heard this tale before, born to a pretty poor British family.
Okay.
Didn't have siblings. Mom and dad's marriage wasn't great.
Okay.
Mom and grandma kind of raised him. In fact, he lived with his grandparents for a good part of his childhood.
Okay.
Grandmother had a piano in her house. And he just kind of played it. I showed you that commercial earlier, and I don't know how accurate that is. There's this amazing commercial for people who haven't seen it where
I don't even know
what the commercial is selling. I don't care. I'm buying it.
Right. It was like something in Partners where I was like, I guess it's like a legal firm. I don't know. It's so strange because it's just at the very end, it has a logo for them. It was not like Elton John hawking somebody's like legal services. And it was like a biopic done in like 2 minutes. I mean, incredible. Yeah.
And it's basically starting at his current age at a piano, like in a living room by himself, just kind of mindlessly playing a note. And then it has this montage where it starts out at his age now on stage. And then it, throughout your song, it kind of goes backwards through his life.
Right.
Through all the different craziness of his costumes and playing piano on the airplane.
Right.
And all that. And in the recording studio when he's real young and as a kid playing piano in a bar. And then finally the last scene is a little tiny 3-year-old Elton John runs down the stairs on Christmas morning, sees a piano, and plays his first ever note on a piano. And it makes me fucking cry every time I watch it.
Dude, it's really well done. Is it?
It's incredible.
Is all that shit true? Did he get it when he was 3?
Yeah. Yeah, really? I don't know. I read his book and I don't, his autobiography, he didn't describe it as like he ran down and there was a piano for Christmas one day.
Right, but he did get one when, or the family at least got one when he was young.
There was a piano in the house basically from the time he can remember. And the way he describes it, he could just always play.
Man,
he never really had to have a lot of formal training. He did have some formal training, but he said even in that, he was one of the only kids in the class who could just get away with not practicing.
Interesting.
And play. And he just has that in him. And it's funny because throughout his book, I mean, Elton John is a piano guy. That's his instrument. That's all he plays.
Sure.
And throughout his book, it's funny. If you read like John Fogerty's book, man, it's all about guitar. The dude loves guitar. You read Eric Clapton's book, it's guitar. The dude loves guitar. Elton John barely talks about piano in his book. In fact, he has 3 main houses around the world that he lives in, and there is a piano in one of those houses. And he said he's never even played that piano. Like, in his main house in England where he lives, there is not a piano in that house.
What?
It's weird. And he said he can just sit down and play. He doesn't need really rehearsal time. He has that in him.
It's a job now. So he's not like hanging out, making songs all the time. He's just like, yep.
It sounds like he likes to write. He enjoys that, but it does not sound like he enjoys sitting around playing piano for friends and family. He certainly does not like that.
Okay.
It doesn't sound like he enjoys just sitting around, kind of messing around on the piano. Again, if you follow like John Fogerty on Instagram, every day you'll see him sitting in his studio playing guitar by himself, like a kid, like practicing, like a 16-year-old. And he even says in his book, Fogerty's like, I still practice the guitar at least an hour a day. Because I want to always get better.
Right.
And Elton John, the reporter asked him, like, why is there not a piano in your house? And he's like, I play 150 shows a year. The last thing I want to do when I come home is play the bloody piano.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So
that's
he just doesn't have one. And his band will rehearse for weeks without him. His band says, like, he does not rehearse. He doesn't have the patience for it. He doesn't want to rehearse. They rehearse. And then he'll come in literally like the day before the tour starts, play through everything one time. He's ready to go.
And he's perfect.
It's unbelievable.
He doesn't have to rehearse on his own a little bit to kind of get the chops back.
He just has that in his wired into his mind.
Man.
It's really, I admire people who can do that. I don't understand it.
Right. There's so many people who are like, I picked up the guitar and decided I wanted to play guitar. And there's so many of them who are like, I found out I was good at it or something. But this guy, it's just like, it's like another appendage of his. Man,
so
that's nuts.
His dad actually was a musician. His dad was a trumpet player. And his dad really encouraged him to play the piano, but really encouraged him to play like classics.
Classical music, you mean?
Yeah,
or like
his dad that thought that was his mom and dad thought that was like the proper way to play the piano.
Sure.
Well, Elton John, you know, as a kid, it's England, it's the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, you know, he starts to hear this blues, this kind of, you know, black blues music coming out of the US. He starts to hear jazz, he starts to hear rock and roll, and he is like totally taken by it. He loves it, and his parents hate it. His parents like get mad at him for wanting to learn to play rock and roll music on the piano.
To make a child enamored with something than for your parents to say no thanks, right?
Yeah. His dad was like highly discouraging of him playing like rock music on the piano.
Right.
His dad did not like that at all.
Right.
Well, at some point his parents divorce and mom meets stepdad. Stepdad comes into the picture and stepdad is the hero of this story.
Okay.
Basically, stepdad is like, he's in the rock and roll scene. He has connections at bars and pubs all over London. He highly encourages Elton to play the kind of music that he wants to play, which Elton dives right into. And when Elton is a teenager, I mean like 15, 16 years old, his stepdad is lining up gigs for him at bars.
Crazy.
Around England, around London. His dad, his stepdad got him like a standing gig on like Saturday nights at this pub to play. And he just loved it. He fell in love with the lifestyle, the playing live, the people, the noise. He just absolutely loved it. In his book, he speaks really highly of that time.
Huh.
We'll jump ahead a little bit. Anyone listening probably knows Elton John is gay.
Okay, sure.
This was the 1950s. He did not realize that as a kid and didn't even know what gay was.
Okay.
This was not a part of his life as a young person.
Okay.
In fact, that didn't become fully realized until he was in like his mid 20s.
Huh. Okay.
So yeah, he gets these gigs at these bars. His stepdad is like really encouraging of it. And it's really an amazing thing. You and I both had dalliances like with guitar. You know, I played a bass guitar. You played a little guitar when we were teenagers.
Right.
Still do, presumably.
Yeah, once in a while. Once every few years. Yeah.
It's hard to envision being good enough as a teenager. It's hard to envision anyone as a teenager having put in enough time.
Right.
On that instrument to be good enough to go play in that setting.
Right. Exactly. Like the Silverchair kids, you know, they did it. They were like 16, but
okay.
At the same time, they were doing, you know, the sort of three chord grunge thing. Not
sure.
I presume Elton John now probably plays better than he did at 16, but the way he describes it, the way you're describing it, sounds like he might have played pretty good back then even.
Oh, yeah. He could
he's a savant, basically, right?
Very much so, but a savant that's not, you know, so a lot of times savants are like very introverted. Sure. And I think I think he kind of is in his personal life.
Okay.
I think he at some point turned to drugs and alcohol to pull that out of him.
Okay.
I think he was kind of a shy kid. He just starts cutting his chops.
Man, 16.
Cutting his teeth in these bars, which that's a hard setting to play in. I mean,
right.
I've been to shows at bars, and even, you know, I went to a show at a bar a couple of weeks ago, and on some of the quieter songs, I'm like, shut up, people. That's got to be hard to play in that setting, especially as a kid. But man, he did. And I think that's part of what made him really good.
Right.
What better way to really get good than just playing
for people
all
who don't
time.
Like listening to you. Yeah.
I mean, just play.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that's how you get good.
Yeah.
So he forms like this Elton John blues band.
Okay. And this is still like 16 years old, or is it
early 60s?
He does this for a few years, or?
Yeah. So it's early 60s now. He's like a late teenager, early 20s.
Okay.
He meets a couple of friends that are also into like bluesy, you know, kind of American R&B type music.
Sure.
And they play. They get some gigs.
Is he a city boy? That's one thing we didn't mention. Is he like London proper, or is he like, you know, farmland?
A part of London called Pinner, which
okay.
I gather is not a wealthy part of London. They grew up in a quote council house, which my love of the Beatles and Oasis tells me is government housing.
Okay.
And again, common story from that standpoint. Very common story.
Right, right.
So he's got the Elton John blues band. I don't know that there's much remarkable about that. I mean, they tried to write some songs. They played. I mean, it sounds like they had some regular gigs, regular shows, but it wasn't anything that was going to catch on in the mainstream. It wasn't going to make him a star.
Sure.
Like a lot of those guys, you know,
for
it's
some
first
reason,
band
I have it in my head
stuff.
That he's not a songwriter. Is that right? Or
yeah, we're going to talk about that here. We're going to get to that real quick.
Okay.
Because that's when things really start to change.
Right.
So he basically goes on an audition after the blues thing, like kind of fizzles out. He goes on this audition. He wants to be Elton John. He wants to be a rock star.
Right.
And he plays some songs and they're like, yeah, you know, you're a good piano player. You're a good singer, but you really don't have songs. And they gave him this envelope and they said, this guy has been sending us lyrics for a long time. He really needs like a partner. He needs someone to play these songs. And Elton John takes the envelope and he said, like, on the train ride home, he starts reading the lyrics from this guy named Bernie Taupin. And he's like taken aback by the lyrics. They're like amazing. And he's like, yeah, I need to get in contact. But they're just poems, basically.
Yeah, sure.
Bernie Taupin doesn't write music. He just writes words.
Okay.
And he gets in touch with Bernie. They go have lunch one day. And like right away, they're like best friends. They hit it off immediately. And they like start hanging out at Elton's house, and Elton just starts taking Bernie's lyrics and just starts putting them to music. And one of the first songs they wrote was Your Song, which is the first hit he had, and a very famous song, one that you would certainly, it's the song from the commercial.
Okay, right.
They become immediate songwriting partners / best friends. And the record label, they get picked up really quickly. Record label really likes him. And it's funny because the way he describes it is that even to this day, like, he loves Bernie Taupin. Like a family member.
Right.
And he says, like, you know, Bernie's not gay. He's never been gay.
Sure.
But I consider him one of the great loves of my life.
Yeah, exactly. Does Bernie only work with him? Like, basically, I mean, there can be side projects here, side gigs or something. Or is he like, did he turn into a, I don't know what you call it, like an industry writer? You know how, like, for pop songs, a lot of times there's, like, you know, 10 or 15 really big guys in, you know, at different record companies who are writing songs, and they farm them out, you know, to Christina Aguilera or whatever. This guy is like Elton John and Elton John only.
Not at all. Does not. He works with other people, but not on a regular basis.
Right. Okay.
Like the occasional side gig.
There's this guy, Mike Garson, I think, who's like the, he was David Bowie's keyboardist. And you can't, you know, you can't hear of a cool alternative act who didn't try to use him at least for one song. But that doesn't make him, you know, a part of the Smashing Pumpkins. He's always going to be known as David Bowie's keyboardist, right?
Sure.
Similar kind of to that, where, like, he might help with a song or two, or maybe even an album with some people. But he's not an industry face who's just writing random songs and farming them out. He writes for Elton mostly, right?
He is completely tied in with Elton John and always will be.
Okay.
He and Elton John, he should be as famous as Elton John, but he's not. He's never wanted to be.
Right.
He learned to play a little bit of guitar, I think, and Elton through the years, like, has tried to pull him up on stage.
Uh-huh.
He's just not interested. He doesn't want that.
Okay.
He changed. Remember, he's Reginald Dwight. There were a couple of bluesmen that he really, really loved. One was a guy named Elton something. I don't remember the guy's last name. No one I'd ever heard of.
Right.
And then there was another one named Long John Baldry that I really liked. And, you know, he just took the two names and put them together. He thought it sounded better than Reginald Dwight.
Okay. Okay.
Thought it was a better stage name.
Yeah.
Eventually changed. He officially changed his name to Elton Hercules John.
Interesting.
Okay. Like, that is his official name. As of today.
Yeah.
So he and Bernie have a unique relationship in that Bernie and we, you know, as I'm thinking through this, I don't know that we need to go, like, you know, chronologically.
Sure.
We're not going to go, like, and then he did this album, then he did that album.
Yeah, sure.
There's not a reason to do that. I think the story as a whole is just a little bit more interesting than the album by album type thing.
Sure.
So he and Bernie have a really unique relationship in that Bernie basically will give him lyrics. And he said the way it's been from the beginning and the way it is today is he'll sit down with the lyrics and he gives it about 5 minutes and he'll play around on the piano. And if he can't come up with anything in about 5 minutes, he just moves on to the next one. So he said all the songs you've heard, Bernie probably took a long time and great care to write the lyrics. And he said, I just came up with something in a very short amount of time. And there are stacks of amazing lyrics he's written that I couldn't come up with anything and didn't have the patience to keep trying.
Yeah, man, what a technique. That's crazy.
It's a really wild thing. But again, his ability to play.
Right.
Like, one common theme through his life, he has no patience at all.
Was it always this way? Like, right at the beginning, he was that way, or is it now?
Yes.
Because now, you know, Metallica can also really quickly rip through 9 riffs in their head and be like, that wouldn't work, you know?
Sure. It does sound like in the very beginning,
it was a little bit more, like, work, but
now, a little bit. I think in the very beginning, he and Bernie would sit down in a room together.
Okay.
And try to kind of bang some stuff out together, but eventually it turned into Bernie just sending Elton lyrics and Elton saying, all right, I'll use this one, I'll use this one, I won't use that one.
Right.
And writing songs. The other thing is that Bernie had an amazing ability and has an amazing ability to write from Elton's perspective.
Okay.
And so I'll give you a couple of examples, and this will help tell the story at the same time. Elton in his early 20s met a woman. Elton did not realize that he was gay, but apparently, and according to his book, literally everyone who knew him knew he was gay.
Okay.
But he didn't. But he didn't even know what that meant.
Okay.
But everyone knew he was gay.
Now, has he already had partners by this time? Had he only been with women?
He'd only been with women. But it was I don't think it's his mannerism, just the fact that he always seemed more interested and more attracted to men, to other people.
Huh.
But Elton never put two and two together. Like, he didn't understand.
How old was he figured it out?
Mid-20s.
Huh. That's crazy. That's wild. Okay.
But the thing is, again, this was England in the 50s and the 60s. Like,
yeah, it was like a big secret to begin with, anybody was, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. True, so you got to figure, growing up in his life, he probably didn't even know any person who was gay. He certainly knew a person who was gay, but not out.
Yeah, not openly.
Not openly
gay.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. You know, that's wild, man.
So he married this woman.
Does he talk about this in his biography at all? Like, did he feel conflicted a lot as a kid and not know why? Or
I don't know if he felt conflicted, but I think he always felt like he had trouble with women and didn't really know why. And so in this instance, like, there's this woman that he became engaged with, and he said they never had any real physical contact, but he said this was England in the early 60s.
Yeah.
It was expected that you wouldn't have much contact. It was virtuous. It was, you're a real virtuous man if you are willing to wait.
Right.
So he said, neither her nor I thought it was a red flag that we'd never had sex. Like, we didn't think there was anything wrong with that.
Interesting.
I didn't think it, he said, I didn't think it was a red flag that I didn't even want to. Like,
right.
I didn't.
He just thought he was pious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
They really did.
Yeah. 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 Fair enough. Okay. Wild. Well, man, that's crazy. Especially now. But now you're right. I mean, we've always grown up with, like, sexual freedom being like the forefront of, you know, almost, you know, a civil right. Right. For anybody. Right.
Right.
Like, you know, a young person, if they're having sex, it's, you know, not even taboo anymore. Right. You're just like, please use protection. Right.
Right.
Yeah, that's crazy. It's so weird to think that that's only like 20 or 30 years before you and I were young teenage people. And what a different landscape. That's crazy, man.
Well, yeah, that's why if someone today says, like, when I was a kid, you know, someone like my parents' age, when I was a kid, you know, we didn't have very many gay people in our high school. And I'm like, yes, you did.
Yeah.
They just kept it a secret until they blew their brains out when they were 30.
Man.
Like, that's how that worked back then.
Yeah. Yeah. True.
You know? So,
100%, yeah,
you know, so anyway, but what's interesting, and this ties into a song, and it ties into Bernie's songwriting.
Okay.
He's about to get married to this woman. They were in his apartment, and Elton is just internally conflicted. He doesn't really know why, but he's miserable. He doesn't want to marry this woman. And by all accounts, this woman was also a little bit crazy.
Okay.
Everyone knew she was wrong for him. Everyone knew he was gay and he should not marry this woman. He was very depressed and, like, suicidal as the wedding approached. But again, he couldn't really put his finger on why. He just knew he didn't really want to do this. But, like, it's like you were supposed to.
Right. Again, with the pious sort of. What was he raised, like, super religious, obviously? Or is that just a thing of the times?
England in the 60s, everyone was Catholic.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I think he was raised in that same way.
Right. Is he a rebel, or was he just always kind of a good kid in general, except for just liking this music? Or
I don't think he was much of a troublemaker as a kid.
Okay.
I don't recall anything from his book that was like, you know, skipping school and wearing leather jackets and things that scared parents back then.
Now, you mentioned drugs, but that's later in life.
That's later on.
Being around it. Okay. Interesting. Okay.
So he's in his apartment with this woman and another friend of his, a guy named Bernie is there. Then there's another friend of theirs there. Well, Elton, it's hilarious the way he describes it in his book. He's like, I tried to kill myself, which doesn't sound funny on the surface, but he said the reason it's funny is because it was such an obvious cry for help and such an obvious attempt to not kill myself. Basically, what he did was he turned on the gas oven, stuck his head inside, but left the oven door open and opened up a window in the kitchen to let all the air in so that he wouldn't. And he's like, so his friend comes in and sees him and, like, pulls him out of the oven. He's like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm going to kill myself. I can't marry this woman. And finally, his friend basically slaps him. And he's like, Elton, no, you can't marry this woman. You are gay. And Elton was like, what does that mean?
Oh, man. Like, he literally, it wasn't that he even, like, knew what it was and then kind of later discovered he,
right.
Like, he had no idea, like, at all until the moment.
He said he'd heard the word, but he really didn't know what it meant. And his friend was like, Elton, you like men. Everyone knows that. Your future wife knows that. Like, everyone knows that you are gay.
Okay.
And you do not need to marry this woman.
Sure.
Now, oddly enough, this will not be the last time Elton John gets engaged and eventually marries a woman.
Whoa, okay, fair enough.
And the second time was not like 2 weeks later. The second time was in the 1980s, and we will get to that shortly.
Yeah, okay. So right now, though, we're talking mid-20s when he discovers this, right? 24 or something?
Yeah.
He, at this point, has several records out already. We kind of glossed over that he's working with this writing partner guy and that he did get a record deal. Is he super famous by his mid-20s? Is he kind of one of those bands that's been around for a little bit and then like his third record goes crazy? What's the trajectory of his stardom there? How does he get started
out? So this near marriage happened, I think, right before he kind of made it, right before his first album came out and everything.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe a couple of years before. So he was...
And was he hot right from the beginning? Like the first album like was mega? Okay.
So he did make an album previous to that that didn't really do anything.
But sure.
After he got together with Bernie, the record label signed him. He put together kind of a band, a real band. His first album, which was just called Elton John, had two pretty big hits on it. And yeah, it was pretty big right away.
What couple of hits were the
your song?
Yep.
And there's another one called Border Song that I also put on the list for you.
All right, cool.
Those were two pretty good hits. So Bernie has this unique ability to write from the perspective of Elton. So one of the songs I put on the list was Someone Saved My Life Tonight. And that is a song that Bernie wrote about the time that Elton almost killed himself before marrying this woman.
Right. Interesting.
And it's a very autobiographical song. When he does that song live today, he says it's one of the best songs they've ever written together. And it's one of his favorite songs, but it's also one of the darkest. But the song, if you read the lyrics of the song, you're like, oh yeah, check. Yep. This is a documentary of a song, basically.
Yeah. Interesting. I'm about to go check out the lyrics and go back to listen to that one again. There were several, and I'm not sure if that's one of them. There were several that I recognized from like classic rock radio. Sure. So
that might've been one of them. It was definitely on the radio. You know, I when I saw him in January, I mean, he plays 19 songs and you would have absolutely recognized 18 of them.
Man, that's crazy. I got to check out hit after hit.
Oh, yeah, okay. For sure. So, you know, but also like Border Song. So Border Song was a song that Bernie wrote, not from the perspective of Elton, but from his own perspective of just being an outsider, which also Elton really gravitated towards because he always felt like an outsider for various reasons.
Right.
And this is a great example of them writing together because there's
we haven't talked a lot about him. Was he from London as well? Was he like an American guy? Oh, okay.
All right. No, he's from London.
Okay, cool.
Although now I think he lives in Los Angeles today.
Sure.
Where he met his wife.
At least one of his residences is there, right?
Yeah, he's probably got a few houses. He's
primarily in the Los Angeles one, but sometimes the Paris and Munich and
Well, I know he's got a nice 3-2 in Mansfield. Everyone does.
Everybody's going for Lake Arlington, but can only afford Mansfield sometimes. So.
Well, they have a Wendy's down there now. That's and Bernie true. Was yeah. like, I gotta go. I gotta get in on these spicy Arlington, nuggets.
Texas, Mansfield, Texas. That's one of the few places where all four corners of one of the major intersections has a Wendy's, right? Every single corner. Yeah, okay.
It was like four Wendy's and the staffs all fight in the streets.
Right.
West Side Story. So, you know, but, you know, they write Border Song and Elton puts it to music. And then Elton actually wrote the last verse of that song.
Okay.
That says, there's a man over there. What's his color? I don't care. He's my brother. Let us live in peace.
Yeah. Now, is that a thing? Does he write every so often? Does he usually write about half of the songs? Is it like once every album or?
I think in that situation, he just thought it could use another verse. I think he will throw in a lyric here and there, throw in a line here and there. But as a whole, He's not a lyricist.
Yeah.
It's not what he does.
Yeah. Okay. Crazy. What a weird dynamic. That's a strange. I mean, I get it. Like we mentioned the Christina Aguilera thing earlier, where there are writers and these people are not writing songs, but it's just so strange that this guy is an instrument, is basically an appendage he wasn't born with, but basically works that way for him.
Yes.
And the lyric part is just like not, maybe he even can do it all right, but it just not his particular, you know, I guess, you know, choice of what he wants to do.
So he gets a manager. His manager is gay.
Okay.
And they go to the US after his first album comes out, and they play a very famous show at the I think it's the Troubadour or the Whiskey a Go-Go. Now I gotta look it up. It's a Troubadour.
Okay.
This is his first time
in the US or?
Yeah, this is his first time in the U.S., first show in the U.S. The Troubadour holds 300 people. My God, to have been in that room that night.
Right.
He plays the Troubadour, and apparently, like, you know, that's one of those things, and we said this in the Oasis episode, when a band comes over, that first show at, like, the Whiskey a Go-Go or the Troubadour, man, that is a show basically for the press, right?
Yeah.
That is a show for the press to come out, for the record label to shake hands, buy drinks. But apparently the American press was like, this kid is amazing.
Right.
Like they immediately were on board, and he was a star in America right away. Like songs on the radio. He was a hit.
Huh.
That night after the Troubadour, he finally officially becomes a gay man by sleeping with his manager.
As you do.
Is he
Led Zeppelin? Like, does UK not give a shit about him and he's huge in America, or
no, it kind of happens all at once.
It kind of happens all at once. Yeah.
This relationship with his manager sounds like it is very, I don't know about damaging. Very toxic.
Yeah.
It's a toxic relationship.
Okay.
The entire and he used this guy until like the early 90s.
Okay.
They were not in a relationship that whole time. But he, that manager, and the manager was known to be very. Did you see the Bohemian Rhapsody movie?
I did.
That same guy, the sleazy manager in that movie, was Elton John's manager.
Oh, okay. So he went on, or well, like that's right. He was from the record company to begin with.
Yeah.
So he was just one of those guys who managed some of the big bands, Elton John being one of them. Was Elton John his breakout, so to speak? And then he became who he was. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
One of those guys, kind of like if you ever read about like Irving Azoff, like he managed the Eagles, but then he also went on to manage a bunch of other people.
Right. Okay.
You know, once you get one big band under your belt, you're
good to go.
You're wanted by everybody.
Okay. No matter how toxic you are, apparently.
And this manager, I mean, the guy sounds like he was an alcoholic. He was volatile. He would do things that you need a manager to do in the early days. Like a club doesn't pay up, so he's going to go beat the shit out of the club owner.
Right.
He would do things like that.
Yeah. That doesn't really go hand in hand with, emotional stability and friendliness.
Especially for a guy struggling with his own stability, his own sexuality.
Right.
It was a toxic relationship. There's a video. Elton did a song back in the early 2000s called This Train Don't Stop. And the video is really good. I should have sent it to you, but it's Justin Timberlake dressed as a young Elton John.
Okay.
And he's basically slowly, it's kind of slow motion, walking through a very wild backstage looking area.
Uh-huh.
There's people making out, there's people doing drugs, and there is one part where you see a guy in a suit punching someone else, and they said that's the manager. Like they had to put him in the video punching someone because that's what he did so much.
Man.
So this is where a couple of really interesting things happen, I think.
Yeah.
They come out with the first album. They come out with the second album. It's a very basic trajectory. Like things get good, then they get better, then they get better.
Okay.
Then they get red hot to the point where it's not sustainable. And then it becomes not quite as successful because you can never reach the heights of that biggest success. And even though you're still selling millions of albums in the 80s, you don't feel nearly as successful as you did in the 70s.
Right. Because new stuff put out, nobody's really got a taste for, right?
Yeah. So this is early 70s. We're still on the upward swing here.
Sure.
We're on our way up. There, he is making an album called Madman Across the Water. Madman Across the Water is what has Levon. It has Tiny Dancer. It has the song Madman Across the Water, which I think I put on the list. Really, really great song. Not a radio hit, but I love it.
Okay.
They made the album in like 8 days. Something insane. Okay. Which, a band now would take eight days.
That lines up with him writing songs in five minutes and such.
And being able to just play the piano.
Like, yeah.
Mistake-free, basically. Also,
it helps that he's the guy, right? He's the whole band. They got studio musicians who can play along and whatnot, and they're already always ready to go. But there's no politics around it. There's no rehearsing and negotiating who's going to get a solo, you know.
Yeah. So there is a guitar player that he brings in for a session named Davey Johnston. Or Johnstone.
Okay.
Davey is a... he's still with him today. And... he comes in to do just a guitar part, just like an acoustic guitar part. And Elton likes him. He was really just meant to come in and do a studio gig.
Yeah, yeah.
But Elton likes him, and Elton told Bernie, he's like, I think I want to get Davey in the band. I want to make him part of the band. Mm-hmm. And Elton didn't know this, but Bernie was like, yeah, Elton, Davey is a Scottish folk guitar player. Not really a rock guy.
Right.
I don't even think he plays an electric guitar. So Elton talks to Davey Johnstone. He's like, I want you to join my band. I really like... He just liked his vibe.
Yeah,
he just liked the guy. He's a cool guy. He liked the way he played kind of an understated guitar on whatever song he was playing on. And Davey tells him the same thing. He's like, yeah, I'm just a folk acoustic guitar player. I don't really do electric rock and roll music. And Elton's like, ah, you can learn to play electric guitar.
Yeah.
And Davey's like... All right. And so he does, and he learns. He said he literally had never picked up an electric guitar before he played with Elton John.
But he played acoustic. I mean, I don't know. I guess there's like slides and all this kind of stuff, hammer-ons and shit that does not work on acoustic, and it's not even part of folk, right?
So acoustic folk music, I'd say, is a pretty different world than electric guitar. But, you know, I agree. If you know your way around a guitar in any genre, you can probably figure it out in a lot of other genres.
Yeah.
Especially if it's folk music.
Does he become a guitar virtuoso, or is he still kind of have this understated style?
No, he is a badass.
Okay.
On an electric guitar, that guy can wail.
Is he just Elton John's guy even to today, or has he been in other bands?
Okay. Nope. I was almost as excited to see him on stage as I was to see Elton when I saw him. He's legendary. He's been with them since the early 70s. They have had some times through the years where Elton will go on tour with like a couple of different guys. But since like the late 80s, that really hasn't happened.
Right.
Like, he has been the guitar player from the early 70s through today.
Crazy. It's so weird. I never think of Elton John as associated with any kind of guitar, period. But I haven't listened to a lot of the songs, so maybe the hits that are on the radio are all just piano and like really, really background guitar, if anything.
So you know the song Rocket Man?
Yeah.
And you know there's that slide that
that's going to be. Yeah.
Okay, so he said that was one thing he loved about Davey when he first played that part. He was like, most guitar players would have come in and tried to throw some kind of solo on it.
Right.
And he said the way he played the guitar to really blend with the song and not overtake the song, but really be an accent.
Yeah, okay.
He said he's brilliant. I mean, he's a really great guitar player. And I do think, I don't know Scottish folk music. I would imagine it's relatively complicated to play.
Sure.
And I've always heard, as someone who doesn't really know how to play guitar other than a few chords, rock and roll music is some of the easiest music to play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you compare it to blues, jazz, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
So I'm sure if he's a good folk guitar player, picking up an electric guitar, plugging it in, and playing some electric guitar is probably no problem for him whatsoever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
He is a big part of the sound of that band, and he'll play some heavy parts that in Funeral for a Friend, you know, leading up to the kind of the intro that where Elton starts singing, where Love Lies Bleeding starts. I mean, he's got some heavy, heavy guitar in that song.
Awesome.
And it's really good. All the Girls Love Alice, is another one where he's got a great guitar sound, on that song.
Okay.
So,
but still, primarily, obviously, it's Elton John and the band. So, still, primarily, always piano music. There's not an album he cut out there where it's mostly guitar, right?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. He never did. Like, if you go see Billy Joel, this drives me nuts. There will be songs where Billy Joel comes out from behind the piano and puts on a fucking guitar and stands on the front of the stage with a Fender that looks like it's not even plugged in and sings, you know.
Yeah.
Elton, to my knowledge, has never done that.
Right. Okay.
And I don't expect he'll start now.
Yeah, sure.
He is piano not. And only piano.
Yeah.
In fact, he doesn't even sing. Like, there are songs where, you know, Billy Joel doesn't play anything. He just sings. And no, Elton is on the piano every song.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so he finds this guitarist. This is during the recording of the second record. Is that right?
Second or third.
Okay.
Pretty early on, though.
Yeah.
Pretty early on. And so then he has a band. This is kind of the beginning of the Elton John band. There was another Nigel, a guy named Nigel on drums, who is playing with him still today.
Okay.
And there's a bass player. The bass player is no longer with us. But that was kind of the Elton John band. And they played pretty much exclusively together until kind of the early 80s, early mid 80s.
Okay.
And then they did some stuff apart from each other. So now, some interesting things start happening here.
When these guys came into the band, did they write songs, or is it still the exact same writing dynamic?
No.
And they were mostly, you know, like filling in whatever else?
Their band. They are hired hands.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
No, they're not doing any real writing. They might come up with some things here and there.
Sure.
I'm sure, you know, Davey Johnstone will say, hey, I think this guitar part would sound good.
Sure.
Right. This comes down to the age old thing of, at what point do you get credit?
Yes.
For the work you did.
Right.
And what should be considered creditable? And, you know, how many side men are out there who are like, man, I wrote that bass part.
Right.
But I don't have a writing credit on the song.
Right, right.
Even though I came up with it.
Right.
That's why they call it a word for a third. Gotta get a word in there.
Right.
Gotta get a word in there.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to click through his records here. Is it always, all the writing credits are always him and the other guy, and that's it?
No, through the years, I mean, eventually he did partner up with some other songwriters through the years, but he always comes back to Bernie.
Yeah. Interesting.
Bernie has been, then there was a time in the early 90s when Bernie was like, hey, let's go back and do it like we did in the 70s. Like, I'm going to write some lyrics, give them to you. You write the music. Let's get the Elton John band in a studio and let's bang out an album in like 10 days.
Right, right.
And because through the 80s, it got very 80s, you know, overproduced and all that stuff.
Right, right.
So this is where the drugs and alcohol start to come in. Elton realizes he's gay, understands what that means, starts to just really enjoy life on the road. This is the mid 70s now. They have a private jet. I think they called it the Starliner or something like that.
Okay.
That had a piano, had a full bar. It's just a party. It's a party in the air. And he said, so like they would, you know, leave a show, get on the jet and party all night till they get to the next town.
Man.
On the plane.
So that Elton, that part of that commercial where it shows him playing piano and everybody's partying around him. That's autobiographical.
Very autobiographical.
Okay.
Very much so. And there were times when they would have to badger him into playing piano because he didn't want to. He described sometimes in the book where he is like, you know, asleep in his little bed.
Right.
And they're like, come on, Elton, come play, come play, come play. And like begrudgingly, he gets up and goes and plays with everyone. But, no, it's a party. I think, Zeppelin had a similar,
yeah,
plane.
Yep, yep.
I'm quite sure Guns N' Roses had a very famous plane. That plane still has meth in it today, I bet.
Right, yeah.
The Guns N' Roses plane does. Well, they're all sober now, but
that Led Zeppelin one maybe too. Just depends on when they were touring. They almost got into the 80s.
I mean, I saw a picture of the Zeppelin plane on Twitter the other day, and it was like Jimmy Page and Robert Plant. There's a couple of girls, and there's a wood burning fireplace on the fucking airplane.
Wow! Yeah, of
like
course.
It's the most 70s thing I've ever seen
Jesus,
in my life.
That's nuts.
So yeah, I mean, this is the life. I mean, he's just living it up, having a grand time on the road. He has said in his book.
All the records, by the way, I've been flipping through them. All of them are written by Elton John and Bernie Taupin. There's like one record, weirdly, where like three or four of them have some other writing credits as well. It's none of the guys you mentioned, I don't think. But it's like three or four of the songs. But
what
I just got to the greatest hits one, and the greatest hits, every single one of them, those two guys.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
No, Bernie, I think Bernie is, he has the perfect level of fame. He is wealthy beyond his wildest, beyond any of our wildest dreams.
And nobody recognizes him.
But he can go anywhere he wants, yeah, anytime.
100%.
Elton John, we'll get to this, but I mean, absolutely felt very boxed in by his fame.
Right.
Very frustrated that he couldn't just go out.
Right.
And enjoy himself. And that happened like overnight. I mean, it happened very quickly. And I don't think any of us,
yeah,
could,
man,
ever be possibly equipped to deal with that type of change that quickly.
In mid-20s, too. Not even fully yourself.
In your mid-20s.
And as he's discovering his sexuality stuff at the, yeah, same time, too. Yeah.
And it's not like you, and it's not like you have this amazing support system.
Yeah, right.
You know, you're on your own with a bunch of other dudes the same age who want to party just as hard as you do.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
He has said he certainly should have gotten AIDS.
Sure.
But he didn't. He said because he was still not unsure of his sexuality, but he was scared.
Sure.
He was scared. And he said what he would do is he says this in his book with a chuckle. He's like, he would invite men back to his hotel or to his house in England. And he would basically invite like groups of gay men and like direct them. He'd be like, all right, now I want you with you doing this. And then I want you over here. Like, man, he would just sit and direct.
Fucking megalomaniac. Like, that's crazy.
That's what he did for years. He said, that's what I did. He said, that's why I didn't get AIDS.
Man.
Because he said, I was watching people be promiscuous, but I wasn't really promiscuous myself.
Man, he's like such a sheltered guy, it sounds,
yeah,
like.
Very, yeah, very,
yeah,
very,
okay,
much.
Yeah. You know what's weird? This Greatest Hits record does not have Tiny Dancer on it. Is that something, maybe we'll get into this later, is this something that happened later in terms of it being super popular?
This is funny, because in his book he actually references this.
Okay.
Because I remember Tiny Dancer, as you do, on the radio.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
As a kid.
Like, yeah.
Everyone knows that song.
Right.
I remember the DJ on KZPS making a joke that it's Hold Me Closer, Tony Danza. Back when they made gay jokes on the air.
And Tony Danza was a name.
Everyone knew who Tony Danza was. So Elton mentions this in his book that, you know, Mad Men Across the Water was this little album and didn't really have any hits. And right away, I'm like, it had Tiny Dancer and Leave On. Those are massive hits.
Right.
And he's like, didn't really have any hits, but then the movie Almost Famous came out and Tiny Dancer was in it. And all of a sudden, Tiny Dancer was a huge hit and everyone wanted to hear it in my concerts.
Interesting.
And I'm like, I don't think that's accurate. I think Tiny Dancer was, I don't know.
Yeah, because I remember, I definitely remember the first time I saw Almost Famous, I was able, of course, to sing along with them when they're singing an airplane to it. I mean.
Which, it also contradicts it, because in the movie, clearly it's a hit, because they all know it.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
They all know it. And so, but I think, so there's two possibilities.
Maybe it was a hit stateside a little bit more.
Exactly.
You know, or, yeah.
So that's exactly it. So the song is written about Bernie's wife. That is about the woman he met in Los Angeles. And the song, you know, Blue Jean Baby, L.A. Lady, seamstress for the band. Elton said she would make our outfits in the beginning, like in the early days. She would make our stage outfits. So, again, very autobiographical.
Right.
That song is about Bernie's wife. And but it's very L.A. centric. I mean, it's a L.A. song. And so, yeah, maybe it wasn't a big hit in England or something like that. That's why he has that perception. But to me,
No,
man, that song was always a hit. Maybe it didn't come along until classic rock. Classic rock radio, we cannot underestimate that. That probably made some songs hits that might not have been hits originally.
Pulled some stuff out that were gems that kind of didn't really chart so much.
Well, like the Eagles have said, like their popularity soared when classic rock radio came around.
Right.
Because all of a sudden, like, their songs were just everywhere.
Right.
And in a place where they weren't before. So classic rock radio probably made hits out of some stuff that maybe were minor hits in the 70s.
Right, right.
Because they just get played. You know how those stations go, man? They play the same songs over and over and over again.
Well, man, I mean, charts-wise, U.S. Billboard 41, that was the peak it did. There's some other, like, smaller, like, I don't know, Cashbox Top 100, 29. Yeah, peak position in UK was 70.
Yeah.
US in 2019 on the US Hot Rock and Alternative Songs list, it peaked at number 6. But in 72, yeah, no, it definitely was not a not a top hit. It wasn't a number one, which maybe is what to him is a hit, right?
Right. Yeah. I don't know. It's when I heard that in his book, I was like, Elton, someone should have corrected you. But yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. So we get to about 73 and we get to the album, what I consider his absolute masterpiece, worthy of listening to start to finish. It's a double album called Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Right.
It is a absolute opus for Elton John. It is so good. And it was a massive, massive hit. So a couple of things about it. Number one, there is a song called All the Girls Love Alice. This is Bernie basically writing about a girl who is confused about her own sexuality and eventually gets killed in the streets of London.
Okay.
I don't know if there are examples of other songs written about like a completely openly gay character at the time. But again, I think this is Bernie very much channeling Elton.
Yeah.
And writing this, because the lyrics are not really vague. I mean, it's obvious. I think my dad even told me when I was a kid, because my dad used to always, when you're driving in the car, and he would tell me, he does what I do now, which is a song comes on and he would tell me everything he knows about that song.
Right.
I remember him telling me about, this is a girl. I don't even think I knew the term lesbian. He's like, this is about a girl who like likes other girls.
Right.
And I was like, huh, that's different.
Yeah.
But it is. And that's a quite a unique, and especially the way it goes, like she gets killed basically in the streets of London, in the subway. But it's like,
because of her homosexuality or just,
I don't know if it's quite that explicit, but it certainly implies.
Okay.
That,
it was like, yes, a hate crime thing. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. The lyrics, come over and see me, come over and please me, wait till my husband's away. Like, right.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious what's happening there.
Right.
And it has a couple of others that are just really great. It has Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, which is just a great song. That's what he's ending this tour with, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. My favorite, though, is Funeral for a Friend and Love Lies Bleeding, which is two songs together. I don't know if you got a chance to listen to it.
Uh-huh, yeah, listen to all the ones you had. I think that was one I didn't recognize.
Okay, so it's got this long, kind of dark musical intro.
Right.
That Elton came up with. He was trying to figure out what kind of music would he want at his own funeral. And so it starts with this, it's meant to sound like wind going around a graveyard at night.
Right.
And there's kind of a bell ringing, and then it gets into the dark kind of organ music. It's masterful. And that's the opener of the album.
Man.
And I heard a DJ say one time, a radio DJ say, this, you can't describe the feeling of, you go by the new Elton John album, you take the cellophane off, you put it on your record, because you don't know. You don't know these songs. It's not like today where there's previews.
Yeah.
You put it on the record, you drop the needle, and that's what you hear. This long musical interview, like, what the hell is this? I mean, it takes you on a trip right away.
Man, I got to check this whole record out. That's awesome.
Yeah, and it really sets the tone for the album. This is the one that Candle in the Wind is on.
Okay, right,
They're written about Marilyn Monroe. Bernie wrote those lyrics, of course.
Sure.
Like all the others.
Right, right.
The album is massive, changes his life. He said the thing kept selling, which, you know, double albums didn't always do that.
Right.
It's a risk to put out a double album. He said it kept selling to the point where he said, a couple of years later, he was trying to figure out, who is still buying it? Like, who doesn't have it already? Like,
right, right.
Who 2 years later is going to buy this album now? Like, he couldn't figure out where these sales were coming from. But it remained, you know, kind of like a Dark Side of the Moon type situation where people just kept buying it, kept buying it. I mean, I've bought it. I've bought it in the last couple of years.
Right.
And this is where there's just the massive, massive world tour. He's playing stadiums at times. The drug use starts to get pretty heavy. It's a lot of pills. It's a lot, you know, they have Quaaludes and everything back then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's not really into cocaine yet at this point, but he is pretty quick.
73. So I think like that's coming up like in a few years more.
I think he picks it up around this time.
Okay.
And loved it the first time he did it.
Sure.
Actually, I don't think he did. I think he said he didn't like it the first time he did it, but he said, I must not have done enough. So then I tried it again. And then I was like, okay, now I like this. And that began a massive cocaine habit for literally like 10, 15 years.
Right, yeah.
Where he was just doing coke all the time. This cycle continues through the 70s, except for the fact that Goodbye Yellow Brick Road is really the peak. He never did anything else.
So he hadn't been into drugs or drinking really before this point, and that did that kind of bring him down? Or
I think he'd gotten into drinking.
Or he just got to the peak and like, you're not going to bounce back there again?
I think he'd been into drinking just like a normal person would be.
Right.
I think he liked to have some beers after the show and all that.
Yeah.
I don't think it was anything that would be considered like really excessive, but it gets to that point.
Yeah.
Certainly. Right. It grows. And he said, like, being on the road like that is very hard on your body.
Yeah.
And what do? You need a little pick-me-up. Do some cocaine. Right. You want to relax. Drink.
Yeah.
You want to, you know, but you fall into that habit.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's hard to pull yourself out of it, especially when you're on the road all the time.
Right.
You're on the Starflight or whatever it is, this plane.
In particular, the party jet of the entire world. Yeah.
Yeah. You're on the party jet all the time. The tour was massive. So he goes, he starts to, you know, prepare for his next album. It has a couple of hits. Inevitably, though, it's a letdown.
Yeah, of course. Right. Unless it's Wish You Were Here. Any follow on to super big album, usually not going to reach the same heights. Was it total letdown, like didn't sell hardly at all, or just not as big?
Just not as big.
Okay.
It sold. By any stretch, it was a huge success.
Oh, okay.
I have to go back and see what album followed Goodbye. I think it's Captain Fantastic, The Brown Dirt Cowboy. Bear with me.
Sure.
Gotta go find it. I'll just cut this part out.
Sure.
With your masterful editing skills. Yeah, okay, no. So the next one that came out was Caribou. And it's funny because you look at the track listing of Goodbye Yellow Brick Road and it's like hit, 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 hit. Caribou, one hit, The Bitch Is Back, a song you've probably heard.
Okay.
Nothing else you've ever even heard of.
Huh.
Well, one more. So yeah, he does this next album, does Caribou. There's a song on it called Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, which is a hit. You'd recognize it. I didn't put it on the list, but you'd certainly recognize it.
Okay.
All over the radio, all over classic rock radio.
Okay.
He recorded that song and told them, that is the worst song I've ever heard. I hate it. Leave it off the album. And they did not, and it's a huge hit. One of the only hits on that album.
Does he still hate it, or it just he didn't think it was going to do well? Or
I think he still doesn't like it, but
yeah.
It's a hit.
Yeah.
He plays it.
Yeah.
Plays it in the shows.
Okay.
George Michael covered it and gave it new life in the 90s.
Okay.
But you can see the trend. You see all the albums after this and you look at how many like real hits are on it. One or two on a lot of them. But the drug use starts to get heavier. The cocaine use starts to get heavier.
And he's also a piano man, you know, post Led Zeppelin.
Yeah,
it's you know, Black Sabbath, early 70s, right? Mid 70s?
Black Sabbath started in the early 70s.
And then, you know, like Deep Purple. Like, yeah, I mean, like the texture of what rock and roll is like even allowed to be has taken a big turn, right?
Like everyone, I think he struggled to adjust to changing times.
Right.
We've talked about this before, like, I think I've mentioned before, like the Eagles. The Eagles broke up in 1980. They got back together in 1994, which is the best thing that could have happened because they would have put out some terrible music in the 80s.
Yeah, impossible. look at the Pink Floyd, right?
I mean, the solo albums especially.
Yeah.
Like, they just didn't know how to change with the times.
Right.
And do you keep doing what you've always done or do you try to adjust? And then it looks like you're just chasing trends. And, like, it's just, it's hard.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of happening to him and it's getting frustrating.
Sure.
At the same time, his health is deteriorating. He has a show at Dodger Stadium during all this. This is 75.
Okay.
Massive show at Dodger Stadium. All of his family comes in. They're all coming in to see this big Dodger Stadium show. He almost doesn't play it. He tries to commit suicide before like the day before the show. This is depicted in the movie.
Okay.
In Rocket Man.
Okay.
Where he takes a bunch of pills and then jumps in the pool and like drowns.
Okay.
But they pull him out and he's fine and he plays the show the next day.
Uh-huh.
He was just miserable. He was just depressed and miserable. I think the alcohol had really taken hold. The drugs had taken hold. I think his personal life was a wreck. That was always a problem for him. His personal life, he never knew what to do with. He couldn't be an openly gay rock star. He couldn't just have a spouse. He couldn't have a husband.
Yeah.
And I think that really tortured him.
Right. Yeah.
So what do? You make up for it with excess.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you have these gay orgies, these gay cocaine-fueled orgies, which, right. You know, have I done some of that? Sure. But, and, you know, I'm not here to judge.
Right.
You know, that's, I think, the name of our next podcast, Gay Cocaine-Fueled Orgies.
It's going to be a religious one. We're going to go through Bible verses. Right.
I think a lot of that was at PCC, actually. A lot of Pittsburgh Christian College, a lot of gay cocaine-fueled orgies. Yeah. That was what happened in the summertime.
Yeah.
Anyway, no one gets that reference at all, and we'll probably cut that out. Yeah, so,
but like, you said that he actually gets married. Is that later than this, too?
Yeah, we're about to get to that.
Okay. Because, like, I mean, like you said, I mean, like, that's pretty rough. Early 20s, mid-20s, you know? I mean, like, you sound like he was, you know, mid-20s at this point. Like, I don't know. That's about the time, the coming of age in general, someone started to be like, maybe I should have something that's, you know, consistent and not super crazy, you know? And that's, like you said, impossible to do as a gay man in the limelight, right? In the spotlight as a famous person. That's, you know.
So rumors had been out there about his sexuality, and he gave an interview, I think it was to Rolling Stone in the late 70s.
Uh-huh.
I think 78, 79, something like that. And he admitted, like in the open, that he has had relationships with men and women.
Okay.
That was a little misleading, because he really was not bisexual at all.
Right, right.
And today he'll say that.
Sure.
And he hadn't really had many relationships with women through the 70s at all.
Right.
He was with men pretty much exclusively.
Kind of dipping his toes in the water.
In terms of the press angle
of it, yeah.
This is, to my knowledge, the first time any mainstream rock star had come out as gay. I don't think even Freddie Mercury was out.
Freddie Mercury was like on his deathbed or something as when they made a statement about it, I think, right?
Yeah, I think he never publicly said it. His band certainly knew.
Yeah.
And Elton John's band certainly knew.
Sure.
Bernie certainly knew. Everyone around him knew. But, you know, also journalism then wasn't like it is now.
Right.
Now it'd be in the tabloids.
Yeah.
It'd be out.
The first day he's famous, somebody would dig up some record about him.
Yeah. You know? Who's gonna dig it up?
Yeah.
And it just wasn't like that back then.
Yeah. True.
Journalists weren't after the dirt.
Right.
But he gave them the dirt.
Right. And he didn't invite any of them on the party cruiser, probably.
No,
right. Unless
probably
they were,
not.
You know, on the inside anyway. Right.
Maybe. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It comes out. There was certainly some backlash.
Huh. Burning of the Elton John records kind of bullshit?
Not in a huge way.
Okay.
But he did. It caused him a lot of nervousness to have that come out. I mean, he worried about, like, he'd never play again.
Right.
And
or for damn sure, you know, have armed security if he, you know, plays the South of the United States. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean,
In the end, it turned out to not be a huge deal.
Yeah.
It turned out to be okay. And that's kind of what I always say, like, if a Major League Baseball player...
Well, if you have all the flamboyant costuming and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
He did that. And he said in the book, like, he did... The flamboyant costumes came from the fact that he had this kind of very regimented childhood.
Yeah.
Where you were kind of made to wear nice clothes and play nice music and...
Right.
That's what you did.
Yeah, why not go wild with it, right?
So this is how he broke out of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And he loved it.
Yeah.
He absolutely loved it. He does a tour of Russia.
Okay.
And in fact, he was worried because Russia's very, like,
yes,
anti-gay, like, from a legal standpoint.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He and his percussionist, a guy named Ray Cooper, they go and do a tour of Russia, just the two of them. And he said he made the decision to go, and he still does today. He'll still play Russia today. And he said he does that because he thinks that's how you make change.
Yes.
Like,
right.
I agree.
Right.
Being
gay is outlawed, and yet people are celebrating this gay musician.
Yeah.
Like,
he said,
that's going to make people scratch their heads of which part's right. Yeah.
So he said he does, every time he's in Russia, he gives a speech on stage about gay rights and how important it is. And, but he said he, you know, always intends on continuing to play there.
Yeah.
Partially for that reason.
Right. Right. That's cool.
He is one of the first Western artists to play Russia. Remember back then, it was still the Soviet Union. You couldn't, like, just tour Russia.
Oh, shit. He did this in 75 or 76?
79.
Okay.
Yeah. 79. I mean, it was still very much the Soviet Union at that point.
Yeah, like, it's still a decade before the wall comes down, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Damn, that's weird.
No, he goes and plays, and he is one of the only Western artists to have ever done that. Billy Joel did it in 87, but that was kind of right before everything changed.
Yeah.
This was in the middle of it. And here's this gay...
Yeah.
Or they thought bisexual piano player.
Right. That's a fucking rock star move, man. Damn.
There's an album.
I don't care about the guy's sexuality at all. Like,
yeah.
In 1979, going into Russia and being like, what's up?
There's a video where they're like, it looks like they're in like the hotel ballroom, like having dinner.
Yeah.
Like he and Ray Cooper and the crew. And there's a band on stage and people ask him if he'll go play. And he's like, no, I don't want to. And then he's like, but a couple of vodkas took that away. And so he and Ray Cooper got up on stage in this hotel in Russia and played for the crowd. And then he played some actual shows. There's an album of it on Spotify.
That is wild, man. I mean, that's like somebody today. Like, there's definitely, like, Metallica's played Russia and stuff. That's like somebody today going and playing North fucking Korea. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They would be in North Korea playing a show.
Yeah, and that did happen in North Korea a couple of times. Like, oddly enough, like, the WWF had a big wrestling event in North Korea in the 80s.
Okay.
It's on YouTube, man. It's weird.
Okay. You can
find it.
All right.
And then there were rumors that Eric Clapton was going to play North Korea, which tracks.
Tracks. I was going to say, it sounds about on, was this in the last few years? Because that sounds about, like, on key, on...
Yeah, this might have been the early 2000s. But yeah, no, you're right. There's not a lot of precedent for this at all.
Listen, all I'm hearing is that fame transcends borders. That's what I'm learning in this 100%, podcast. Yeah.
100%. That's why we will be doing our next live broadcast from Pyongyang in North Korea.
All right.
Next year.
So if the podcast stops here, you guys know why.
Yeah, this is the relic that you're left with.
So let's get to the juicy stuff then.
He gets, again, there's some frustration. The hits are not coming like they were.
Yeah.
He's still wildly successful. But again, once you've been at that peak, it's hard to accept.
Well, and the changing landscape thing. Again, we're 75, 76. I mean,
yeah. Okay, so let's jump ahead to the 80s a bit. He's in Australia. He has a...
Man, it feels like he could have taken over disco or something. You know what I mean?
Well, he didn't really do that. And that's funny because a lot of bands did. I mean, Kiss basically made a disco song.
Right. Another Brick in the Wall is a disco beat, you know?
The Rolling Stones.
It seems like that would be a natural, like, just a little bit of diversion that would have been awesome. You know,
I mean,
he's not going to become, you know, Black Sabbath or anything. It's not his style, but yeah, interesting.
So he's in Australia, it's early 80s. He's in Australia on a tour. He has a, quote, assistant with him, this male assistant.
Okay.
Who is clearly a man he has just brought with him to be his boy toy on this trip. It's his boyfriend. It is his boy. I mean, in his book, he said it was my boyfriend. It was my secret boyfriend.
Sure.
That no one knew I had, but he was with me on this tour.
Okay.
There was a woman who was like she worked for a record label. She was, I think, from Germany, and she was kind of hanging around the tour. I don't know what her role was on the tour, but she was around, and he really liked her. They got along really well. And he just impulsively one night was like, let's get married. And she was like, what? And he's like, yes, let's get married. We get along great. You'd be a great wife. And let's do it. Let's get married. And she's like, yeah, let's do it. So the next night at dinner, with the whole crew, with his boyfriend sitting there, he announced to everyone that he was marrying this woman, and the whole crowd like audibly gasped. They were like, what? What? And he goes, you should have seen the look on whatever the guy's name, whatever his, you should have seen the look on his face.
On the boyfriend. Announced,
yeah, that I was marrying this woman. And okay. Like, he flies his mother to Australia so she can be at the wedding. A lot of this is trying to please his parents. A lot of what he did around this time, I think, was trying to make his mother happy. And he did something else pretty massive, essentially, to make his dad happy. We'll talk about that in just a second.
So he hits fame, and everybody has that, that wasn't it kind of moment of like, I've reached the peak, and starts searching his heart for like what's still nagging him.
What else?
Right. And it sounds like this parental stuff is some stuff he is really, thinking about a lot and working on.
I think his entire life from being a child, I think he craved stability, the stability of a family. Uh-huh. And he was gay. He couldn't have that.
Yeah.
So what do? You marry a woman, right? And you can have that. And I think he thought he could marry her. And if they were close enough friends, they could make it work.
Exactly.
And he
revealed and all this shit would go away of the not having a companion and some of the other stuff, you know.
He revealed zero details about their intimate life. He did not say whether or not they actually had sex or anything like that.
Sure.
He said that she's never talked about their marriage. And so out of respect for that, he doesn't want to really say anything else about it other than they got married.
Yeah.
They stayed married for like 4 years.
Okay.
And then they divorced in the around 88, 89. They divorced.
Okay.
And that's it. Now, she sued him after his book came out for even mentioning it.
Okay.
Was
the book like the debut of it existing?
I think people knew. It was in the news at the time, so it wasn't like a secret, but I think they had both agreed to not publicly talk about it.
Like, oh, I see.
Agreed on paper, like contractually agreed not to talk about it.
Interesting.
And so they basically just, they call it a day, they divorce. She sued him when the book came out. I don't know if anything ever came of it. He's very complimentary of her in the book, though. In the book, he doesn't speak ill of her at all. Basically says, she was a great wife. I was gay, so it wasn't going to work. That was that was the problem. Okay, around the same time also, he buys a British soccer team.
Why Watford, not? Sure.
His favorite childhood team. He buys Watford. He does this essentially because his dad is a massive Watford fan. Remember, his dad and his mom divorced, and his dad was not a fan of rock and roll music, and I'm going to guess his dad is not a fan of gay people.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of problems there. So he buys Watford. Now, he was a fan of Watford. I think he did think it would be something to kind of keep him occupied outside of music. And he became very involved in the day-to-day running of the team. He took a little bit of time off of music, and like, this is what he did in the mid-80s. He ran this soccer team. And they had success. I forgot what British soccer is weird, the way they define success. They don't have like playoffs and then a championship. They don't do that. But they had greater success than they'd seen in years and years and years when he owned the team. But he said, like, there was a point where he was at a game in the owner's suite with his dad. And like, he's the owner and Watford is playing and they're doing really well. And he said, his heartbreaking part of the book. And he said, I just spent the entire day waiting for my dad to say something like, this is really great. Or I'm really proud of you or anything. Yeah. And he said, his dad just gave him nothing, nothing the entire day.
Man, fuck that guy.
And he said, I mean, but you see how bad he craved that, how bad he wanted that.
And like, again, the fame means nothing, you know what I mean, to him. And he, all he wants is his dad's sort of approval. He's doing these things for him, you know.
I think he would have given it all up for that, you know. And I've heard other people say that. I mean, Eric Clapton, massive family problems. Every rock star we love has massive family problems. Right. I mean, it's just the curse of, you know, that problem is what gives you the drive to do the thing that you do the best.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's a pretty common story.
Yep.
So we get into the kind of the late 80s. He's totally lost at this point. He makes an album called Leather Jackets.
Okay.
Where he said, if you want to hear what cocaine sounds like, listen to Leather Jackets. He said, I was just whacked out of my mind. It sounds awful. Like, it's a horrible, terrible album. Nobody should ever listen to that album.
Does it sound like Elton John kind of phoning it in? Does it sound totally different? How would you describe
it? Yeah. It's Elton John. The songs have just, they have no depth to them. Okay. It's really bad production. It's really, it sounds like even the sound quality is not good. Right. The songs are not good. At this point, I don't think he was writing with Bernie really exclusively at this point. I think they had not taken a break, but, you know, they've been together for 20 years at that point. Yeah, almost. Exactly. So, yeah, you know, okay. He's doing some other stuff, but the album, he said, it sounds thin. There's no bass on it. It's just a bad album. It's terrible.
Right. Right.
But he was whacked out of his mind. He didn't know what he was doing. And he gets to a point where it's like, man, I've got, like, my career is on a serious decline at this point.
Sure.
Like, it's very bad.
But he's fine. Yellow Brick Road is, like, selling or has sold enough money that he's good to go. But he loves performing. So is that what kind of the urge to keep going on is coming from? Oh, who cares? Yeah. If he's over his peak, you know, why not just go be a rich guy and have fun, right?
Well, why do any rock stars keep making bad albums? I mean,
because dad won't say anything nice in the skybox.
Dad won't say anything nice to them. That's right.
Yeah, that's true.
But I mean, all these guys keep making records. Why do they do it? Do they need to? Hell no, they don't need to. Does Robert Plant need to make another bluegrass album? No, he does it because he loves it. Right. You know, does Paul McCartney need to make another album? No, he does it because he's got an ego the size of Texas.
Right.
And he needs to prove to everyone that he can still make good music even when he's 80.
Yeah, yeah, fair.
Even though it's entirely unnecessary.
Right.
I would imagine even in the late 80s.
So Elton John, pretty big ego as well? Or
I think so. Well, and I think the need for attention is pretty high with him.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, laughably high, really.
Just look at the costumes, man, and the showmanship. Like, that commercial shows, like, this one point where he, like, jumps up on top of the, you know, piano.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just going wild. I mean, it's awesome.
And he does some things in this time that are pretty huge. I mean, he plays a huge Central Park show in New York City.
Okay.
He goes to Australia. There's an album of this, and it sounds pretty cool, where he does some shows in Australia with, like, the Australian Symphony Orchestra or whatever.
Okay.
Where it's, like, it's really good.
Yeah,
During those shows in Australia, he's having massive throat problems. He said at this point he was smoking weed every day, drinking a lot and doing a lot of cocaine. Like, he's just doing it all.
Yeah.
And he said he is developing this bad throat problem during these shows in Australia that are huge shows. You can't cancel them. Like,
these are
sold out shows with the symphony orchestra. Like, there's too many moving parts to cancel. So he's just doing these shows in massive pain. Finally, he goes to the doctor in Australia. The doctor's like, you need some pretty big surgery on something back there. You've got these polyps and you got to quit smoking
on the vocal cords
on the vocal cords.
Oh fuck, man.
And he's like, we're going to have surgery and to get those out. There's no other way to do it. You're gonna have to quit smoking weed. The smoke is really irritating everything back there.
Uh-huh.
And so after the last show in Australia, he has this surgery in Australia. And if you see video of Elton John now, his voice is noticeably deeper.
Yeah.
And he said that happened after that surgery.
It's deeper.
He said his voice suddenly had a lot more bass to it after that surgery.
Yeah.
And he liked it. He said, I loved it. I thought it was a great change. He said, I was okay with it. Like, it didn't bother me at all.
Man, what luck. That's crazy.
But he said, his voice, like, really changed after that surgery. And it's very noticeable.
Right. That's interesting because, I just thought that basically as he got older or something, his voice, like, deepened out a bit. You know, that's wild. It's like the result of a surgery.
Yeah, it is. A lot of times, guys get older. A lot of these guys, they smoke their whole lives, like smoke cigarettes their whole lives.
And
kill your voice. And, I think that's, like, if you watch any videos of Bon Jovi right now, he cannot sing.
Right.
Like, he cannot. He's getting destroyed. I've seen article after article of what's wrong with John Bon Jovi's voice.
Right.
He's bad. And I think he's been a smoker
his whole
life.
That's a damn shame, man, because that's a classic one.
Yeah, that guy could belt it out. He was amazing. And now he sounds terrible, and he's not that old. I mean, he's around 60. Like, he should still be able to sing. Elton John, I think, sings better than Bon Jovi right now, and Elton John's 75 years old.
Yeah, right.
So he gets a at some point in the very early 90s, maybe late 80s, he gets kind of a stable boyfriend, stable relationship.
Okay.
And he gets, again, heavier and heavier into cocaine. He has this bit, he has a couple of incidents around the band. Like, there's one point where they're making a video and he just gets blackout drunk and he wakes up and he's got like a black eye and his hands hurt and he doesn't know why. And the next day they have to tell him that, like, he became belligerent and just started swinging at people. I mean, Jesus. he's just shit faced.
Right.
But none of that caused him to, you know, change anything until finally there was some point where, like, his boyfriend was gone. He was alone at his house in England, and he just went on this, like, 4-day binge of, like, whiskey and cocaine, like, locked up in his house, like, 24/7.
Uh-huh.
And he said he came out of it and, like, felt kind of lucky to be alive. I don't remember if there was, like, an incident. I don't remember that there was.
Right.
I think he just knew, like, I can't keep doing, like, I'm depressed. The drugs are making me depressed.
Right.
They're controlling my life. I've got to do something. So he tells his boyfriend, like, I need some help.
Sure.
What do I do? And he had three main addictions. He said it was alcohol, it was cocaine, and it was shopping. Like, he famously spends insane amounts of money.
Sure. Just,
his burn rate is very high. That's one reason why he's had to tour through these years. Cause he spends a wild amount of money on things that no one else would spend money.
Right.
You know,
okay.
His
art jogging, collecting, that kind of shit. Like, just
art collecting, but it's also other things, like his jogging suit that he might just put on in the morning to make breakfast is Gucci and it costs $20,000. Yeah. You know, it's that kind of stuff.
Yeah. As you do.
He doesn't
have to spend it on pianos, as we talked about earlier on. So, I mean,
yeah,
you know, hey, he's making it work.
He's also surrounded by yes men.
Yeah.
Who's going to tell him no?
Right.
And in any relationship he's ever been in, he's got the money. Who's going to tell him not to spend it?
Yeah. Right, you know, right.
Who's going to tell him to stop doing cocaine? No one is going to tell him that. So he tells his boyfriend, like, I got to find some help. I got to go to rehab or something. Where can I go that will treat all three problems at once? Cause I don't want to go to three different rehab facilities. So they find this rehab facility. There was one place in the US that they found, and it was a hospital in Chicago, like a hospital, like not a Rolling Hills, Betty Ford.
No, just like this a psych ward of a hospital or something?
Hospital in downtown Chicago.
Okay.
He gets dropped off at the hospital and he doesn't even go. He like stands on the curb. He's like, I'm not going in there. He's like, he did not know that that's what it would be. And he's like, I'm not doing that. And he's like, no, you got to go. So he goes in and he said, I mean, it was a life-changing experience. I'll just skip ahead and say he has been clean and sober since he entered this facility in the early 90s.
Yeah. Okay.
Stayed clean and sober. He still is today. There are several times in the first few days that he leaves. He packs up his shit and he goes out on the curb looking for a cab.
Right.
And then he waits a minute, calms down, goes back. Because no one's ever challenged him. No one's ever told him, like, what you're doing is bullshit. What you're doing is wrong. And he didn't like hearing that because he's been a star from the time he was an adult.
Yeah. No, from the time he was a kid, basically. I mean,
yeah, he has.
He started getting the praise at 16 in those bars, right?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
So he goes to rehab, and he said there's a couple of things that were really that really stood out to him. Number one, you know, in rehab, you're not a star; you're on the same level as everyone else, and he'd never been that before.
Right.
He'd never been in that position before. Also, he said part of rehab was they give you like $10 a week. You don't have your wallet. So they give you like $10 a week to spend at the commissary to buy treats, buy a Kit Kat, buy some Gatorade, you know, spend it on what you want.
Right.
Little creature comfort. He had no concept of what anything cost.
Right.
Like he said, I did not know if a pack of M&Ms cost $10 or 10 cents. I had absolutely no idea how much stuff cost.
Right.
And he said that made me realize I didn't know how much I was spending. Like, this vase that I found in Venice that I just say, I want that. All he'd ever had to do, George Harrison said the same thing one time. All he has to do is point at something and say, I want that, and I have it. And no one even tells me how much it costs. I don't have to. George Harrison said, in my whole life, I'll never know what it's like to work for something that I want. to work and save for something that I want. Elton was in the same position. A lot of those guys.
Yeah. Right, right, right.
Just no concept at all. So he gets through rehab. They tell him in rehab, like, you and your boyfriend are not going to make it. Like, relationships don't last through rehab. You're going to change too much.
Boyfriend and enables it, or just the fact that the person's going to change so much?
It's just going to change.
Yeah.
It's just going to change. It's not going to be the same. And
yeah.
And that was true. His boyfriend lived in Atlanta. Now, this created a love affair with Atlanta that Elton John still has today. He has a home in Atlanta, which is weird. Huh. I don't. If you're going to have a home in the U.S.
U.S. cities, you know, it's New not York, one of the top LA. Ones that you'd be like, yeah, you go down the list a little bit, right? Chicago would be before Atlanta, you know, bigger ones would be before you get to that level. I mean, you know, Indianapolis, I don't, you know what I mean? It's like, kind of like that.
Yeah.
We're like, yeah, I don't know, yeah. I guess.
You know, it's Cleveland. Weird. Atlanta's a big town. I'd say it's better than Cleveland or Indianapolis.
I mean, it's a great city from what I understand. But like, yeah, like Miami, but it's right? San Francisco. It's the South. You know?
I mean, it's the South, man. It's Georgia. Yeah. Like, it is the South. And so, but he loves Atlanta. To this day, he loves Atlanta. Still has a home there. Still spends some time there.
Yeah.
So things calmed down a bit. You know, he's now clean and sober. His house in England, he said, was basically a 70s rock star house with pinball machines everywhere and, you know, bars in every room. And
this is what I'm trying to get to now in 2022. This is
I'm working towards that. His house sounded awesome.
Right.
He spent like 2 years living in a guest house so that he could have his house totally redone. He said to make it look like, quote, an adult lived there.
Right.
And he had his house totally revamped. He's had this house since the early 70s. He still lives in it today, full time. Totally remodeled it. You can find it online. Architectural Digest, I think, did a story on it. You see a lot of pictures. I mean, it's a nice house, surprisingly so. shockingly, not a 3-2 in Mansfield.
And he got rid of
the pinball machines. Man. I think his kids now are like, Dad, could we bring the pinball machines back? That sounds awesome.
Yeah, right.
So now the problem is he's clean, he's sober, he is single, and he doesn't like that. Doesn't want to be single. So what he does is someone he knows in England, he tells them, I want you to invite, like, find some gay men that you know in England and invite them over to my house for dinner. All at the same time. Not for an orgy, like truly for dinner.
Right.
He's lonely. The Bachelor, the gay edition, right?
If Elton gives you a rose, you get to come to the next dinner.
But also he's lonely. And part of the problem is he said, like, people have to come to me. I can't go to dinner.
Yeah.
I can't go to dinner with a stranger. I can't do that. Yeah. And so people have to come to me.
He can't go to dinner in public in general, you know? I mean,
no, he can't. Yeah. And so he said he, one night he said, just find some gay men around England that are nice guys that you like. And I want to invite them over to dinner. So he does. And sure enough, one person from this dinner really stands out. And, they hit it off, and this guy he's his husband today. They're still married today.
Yeah.
This guy was like an executive. He's from Toronto, but he's living in England, worked some big shop for some company, wasn't even openly gay.
Yeah.
His parents did not know he was gay until he told his parents he was dating Elton John. Has to be quite the double shocker to your parents.
Well, I mean, at least you're a power gay. That's pretty interesting.
Superpower
couple,
said,
CEO and Elton John. That's crazy.
What if you called your dad right now and said, Dad, I'm gay. Also, I'm dating Billy Corgan.
Right.
Would he have some questions? Would he be confused by that?
Right. He would first say, okay, so who's Billy Corgan? I would just make it worse for me, honestly. So.
And he did say his husband is an amazing stabilizing force. His husband encourages him like to go. His husband was like, no, you're not going to be a shut-in. We're going to go out. We're going to do this. We're going to live a normal life. And
to be shut in, like basically this thing you described earlier, which is just have people bring people over to party. And just like a recluse. Interesting.
Yes, he was, because he couldn't go out. It would get too crazy. But I also think there's something that happens when you're a celebrity. You go out all the time and eventually it does calm down a bit. Yes. You also just learn how to do it. You know how to call ahead to restaurants and say, hey, I'm coming. Can you get us a private room in the back?
Right,
exactly. Things like that.
It depends on where he lives. If he still lives kind of in that area where his parents were, like if it's small-ish corner of the area, people know he you're there, right?
Right.
You know, a lot of people know where Nolan Ryan lives in Texas, right? Or where he has a house or something. And it's like, I think it was Georgetown, right? I think I lived pretty close to where he was for a year. And I never saw him around. But if I did, I wouldn't have been, you know, all up in his business, you know.
Speak for yourself, sir. I would have.
Well, that's because I have the photo with him already that I met him on the way to get on an airplane. So, you know.
Who needs that?
On the Southwest Party Jet economy class. So,
were you at the piano that day with Nolan Ryan? And I've seen video of, like, Paul McCartney walking around New York. And, you know, he'll be in a car. And then he'll tell the car, hey, stop. I'm going to go out and walk a couple of blocks. Just follow me. I'll jump back in when I'm ready. And
because he's gonna have to talk to people, and
the dude cannot go 50 feet before someone across the street goes, hey, Paul McCartney, and then there's 20 people around him
asking for autographs and just pictures.
The man cannot just go anywhere, and I think Elton's in the same boat, but I think you learn how to control it. I'm not an expert on that, but I think his husband kind of taught him, like, no, we have to live a normal life. You can't be a shut-in. And so they, you know, at first are just partners. They, Elton gets really involved with, like, an AIDS foundation. Like, he creates his own AIDS foundation. And he gets, like, really involved in it. Like, it's a passion, a real passion of his, helping AIDS victims all over the world. And in one of these visits, he goes to an orphanage. He goes to an orphanage with his husband, and he meets this kid. He's like 4 years old. Elton John is just completely taken with this kid. And he's like, we have to adopt him. We have to take him home. And his husband's like, this is not the pound. You cannot just pick one and take him home. there's a process.
Did you tell them I'm Elton John? I probably can.
Yeah. He said, but he's like, he immediately was like, I want to raise this child. And he'd never even thought about having kids before.
Yeah.
But he said he meets this kid and he's just like amazed by this kid. He didn't really say what amazed him about him. He just he fell in love with this kid.
Right.
Well, it turns out the kid actually did have a grandmother that lived in the area. So they didn't want to take him away from family. But that got the wheels spinning. Like, we want to have a child. And Elton and the late 90s, they found like a surrogate and had a child. Might have been a little after that, because I don't think that kid's an adult yet.
Sure.
But they had a baby.
Elton John's baby or the other dude's baby?
They don't know. So they both contributed.
Okay.
And then they chose not to find out like whose contribution made the child.
Yeah.
So they decided not to know. So it could be either one of them. They don't know. They don't care.
Does the child look exactly like Elton John or the dad?
I haven't seen a lot of pictures of the kid. It's funny. There is a picture they posted like around Christmas. This must have been later than 99 because the kids are like the oldest one's like 12.
Yeah.
But they posted a picture. So they have two kids now, actually, in the picture. Right. And Christmas, their backs are all to the camera, but they're all wearing these, you know, plush Gucci robes.
Yeah, like, right.
That have their individual names on them.
Right, right.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, you'll see them eventually when they're like of age or whatnot. And, you know, if one of them looks like Julian Lennon, looks like John, you know, it's kind of it's pretty obvious, you know. But
Julian and Sean Lennon both are very clearly John Lennon's kids.
Yeah, exactly.
They look exactly like him. Now, during this time, though, He gets the request to do some music for Disney. And so he and Bernie get to work and they write some songs that I don't care for, but man, you couldn't be a kid in the 90s and escape those songs.
No. Yeah.
Can You Feel the Love Tonight was massive. That was a huge hit.
Hey, to be clear, soundtrack was for the Lion King movie.
The Lion King. Yeah.
Right.
And He was huge.
I think maybe peak Disney animated movie, you know, viewership for a long, long, long time.
Oh yeah,
you know,
At a time when other classic rock acts really were either not putting out new music or putting it out, but to a thud. You know, it wasn't doing anything.
Yeah. Right,
man. he puts out this thing and it is huge. He is massive. And he has two or three hits during that era, big hits during that era. They don't sound like rock and roll, but whatever, sure. Yeah. You know, he's also a 50 something year old man at this point. So, yeah, yeah. You know, it's not going to sound like Tiny Dancer.
Right.
But I mean, he's back on top, touring, selling out stadiums all over the world. He has not left that perch since then. He has been consistently doing that, consistently selling everything out.
The Lion King thing did for him. Like where before, what did he, yeah. Was he just on a hiatus for a few years or just wasn't?
He wasn't on a hiatus. He had actually put out some music after he got sober. He went back and they made a couple of albums kind of like they did in the 70s, kind of a little bit more stripped down.
Sure.
Writing with Bernie the way he used to. And they were really critically acclaimed. But like we've talked about with other classic rock artists, there was no room in the marketplace for a new Elton John album in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
You know, where was it going to get played? Classic rock wasn't going to play it.
Right.
And so, you know, it wasn't making much of a splash, but critics loved it.
Right.
And then he comes out with the stuff that does make a splash and he just gets massive again. And, you know, there's not a lot to say. I think we're near the end of this other than what changed for him eventually is that when he had kids, his kids were born and now we're, you know, to the point where we're just like a few years ago, you know, the 2000 teens.
Sure.
And his husband starts kind of mapping things out saying, okay, you know, the kids are going to be in school starting next year. You know, then they're going to, you know, matriculate to this school. You know, this kid really loves soccer, so he's going to be involved there. And, you know, basically, we're going to need a nanny, but how much of this do you want to be for? And Elton was like, I don't want to miss any of it. I want to be there for every single second. Like, he sounds very appreciative. He never thought he'd have a chance to be a dad.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
As a guy who was a gay man coming up through the 70s, I would imagine... Yeah, I can see that.
Right.
And he fucking loves it. I mean, really seems to really love it. Not
brings
in the way
the kids
people...
on the road with him, that kind of thing, or
yeah. So like he told his husband, like, I don't want to miss any of this. And his husband was like, you cannot tour the way you tour now. Like you're on the road so much and that's great, but you're gonna miss stuff. And he's Elton was like, I don't want to tour anymore then.
Yeah.
I want to stop touring.
Man, what a bamf.
And So he put his husband in charge of like planning the farewell tour. And he basically planned this massive 3-year tour all around the world. Now, a few years before that, he sold his music catalog and he did give money to a bunch of people around him. He paid off a bunch of mortgages for people on his crew. He used that money and like really helped a lot of people to his own detriment because again, his burn rate is so hot as far as the money he spends. Even after rehab, he still loves to spend money.
Sure.
The money that he got from selling his music catalog, which would have been enough for any of us to sustain for several lifetimes.
Right, several.
I don't think it was for him.
Yeah.
So he had purposely scheduled like literally this 3-year long farewell tour, like 2 or 3 laps around the world to, you know, pay himself, pay the crew. Because they're going to be out of a job, pay the band because they're going to be done with him.
Yeah.
And do it. And it's an amazing show. It's the best show he's ever done. Biggest stage setup he's ever done. The sound is incredible. The band is amazing. It's a greatest hits show. There's really no new music other than one new song, but that new song is actually a hit. So it works out. You know, but he fully admits, this is what I thought was interesting about his book. He does not shy away from the fact that he is selfish. He spends an ungodly amount of money on unnecessary things. He has a very addictive personality. He can treat people around him horribly. He put his husband in charge of Rocket Man, the movie, which came out around the same time the farewell tour was announced. And Rocket Man is a musical. So we talked about this via text earlier. If I'd seen it, I've seen it. I didn't care for it because it plays like a Broadway musical. Like there is a scene
rather than
where
just
Elton
like,
John
just like scenes of him playing. It's like all of the plot is via song.
Yes. I mean, there's a scene pretty early in the movie where like a 15-year-old Elton John is playing Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting in a bar. And that's a song that came out when Elton John was not 15.
Right.
And like, you're like, okay, so immediately you're like, all right, suspend all reality. But it does kind of tell the story. But he said when the screening ended, the lights came up and he said, I could feel everyone in the theater. Cause he said he hadn't watched any clips from this movie before it was done. He purposely did not want to see any of it.
Yeah.
And he said, I could feel everyone waiting for me to erupt in a tantrum. And he said, I looked at my husband and I said, don't change anything about this movie. It's perfect. And so he did it like that. But it, and I mean, his husband a few years before that had made this handheld camcorder documentary called Tantrums and Tiaras. And I recommend finding this on YouTube. It's fascinating. It's just his husband with a handheld camera. So this is pre-iPhone.
Yeah.
So he's not like a camcorder. And he's just it's just documenting their day-to-day life, the life of Elton John.
Oh, that's right. That's Tantrum. Like that Radiohead one that's like behind the scenes of the tour and all the monotonous interviewing and stuff. You never see that kind of shit, you know?
So it's called Tantrums and Tiaras because Elton is a queen and also because he throws tantrums all the time.
Yeah.
And I mean, there are scenes in the movie where he is just throwing an outright tantrum. There's a scene where like he gets to a studio to film a music video, but the jacket he's supposed to wear, someone left it in the limo. And someone's like, we're going to call the limo back. And Elton's like, forget it. I'm not doing that. I'm fucking leaving. I'm leaving right now. No one can do anything right. And like he storms out. And then 2 seconds later, he storms back in and he's like, get the limo back. And then 5 minutes later, he's like, never mind. I'm leaving. And like he is a child. He throws tantrums like a 4-year-old. And I think he kind of still does that to this day. And he knows that. He owns it. He's very aware of that.
Just who I am. Yeah.
There was a... it was a Grammys or Rock and Roll Hall of Fame where he was supposed to like present someone and that he got there and it found out it's going to be like 4 hours before he was going to go on. And he was like, I'm not doing that. We're leaving. And they leave, they get to the hotel and his husband's like, Elton, you need to calm down. You agreed to do this. We need to go back. You need to do it. And he's like, okay, we'll go back. He said they left the venue and went back to the hotel and back to the venue literally like 4 times. Before he finally stayed at the venue, he would get there, find it still 3 hours and be like, no, never mind. I'm leaving again. Like he does that, but he tells the story. He owns it.
That's like the quintessential cliche, you know, victim of sycophants, right? People have just told him yes his whole life. I mean,
and he said
all the hard shit that you learn after the age of 16, he never hit any of it, you know?
And he said, I really think, David, his husband, made Tantrums and Tiaras so that the world could see what he had to deal with on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I mean, he's pretty open about that. Yeah. And it's on YouTube. You can find it's broken up into clips on YouTube. It's a fun watch. It's a really fun watch.
Was it like officially released or the guy just kind of put the clips on YouTube?
So no.
Maybe find a place to stream it or something.
Sure.
Or DVD. Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Maybe DVD. If you could maybe find it on eBay or something.
Yeah.
It was made before YouTube. Like this was probably made in the late '90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
Oprah Winfrey once said like they had Elton John on the show one time. You know, you always have a writer where you tell the production crew, this is what I want in the green room. For my appearance. And they said he requested, it was like artists will not perform unless these items are present. And it was like all of these rare jams and breads and nuts and things that he said they said the production crew had to go all over Chicago to find these things. They had to fly some stuff in.
Yeah.
And he did not touch, one bit of it. He didn't touch it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I have a friend who was on a Prince music video set. And I think Prince is famous for, like, was it a camel or something?
Okay.
Something like that where he was shooting a music video and, you know, they wanted a camel. And he was like, okay, well, then, you know, tomorrow let's have a camel. And they're like, That's really not how it works. And they flew one in overnight or something. But this was in the 2000s, way, way after that, when my buddy was on the set. And it was like he had a writer that dictated vegan food for everybody. No question. So there's food is catered, but nobody can, you know, and somebody brought some food on the set that was like their own lunch or something. And he almost quit and not just sort of quit for the day, but like just canceled the music video altogether because of this person unknowingly bringing a sandwich, you know? It's a different world. It's a different experience. I don't know that I'm jealous of that particular part of that kind of life. That's got to be torturous in some ways for the person themselves, you know, because it sounds like he's angry all the time. You know what I mean? He's frustrated constantly.
He's frustrated because he is a man who is used to getting what he wants at the snap of a finger. So when it doesn't happen, he's always had the ability to just walk away with no consequences. So you learn that behavior, you know.
Yeah, 100%.
Metallica said this: when you're on tour, you don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
You know, everything people do things for you. And then you get home, you got to take the trash out.
Right. Yeah.
And it's a jarring effect. Right. And now it does sound like his family, his kids have been a huge stabilizing force. The family is on tour with him. They follow him. They're on it. They're at every show with him. And he did in his book, he says, I absolutely love nothing more than the times when we're at home doing things that I never thought I would do. Like going to Pizza Express, which I gather to be some pizza buffet, kind of like Cece's.
Right.
Which it's like something I never, ever would have thought I would do. And now I love taking the kids to Pizza Express on Friday night. And
that's awesome.
And he's like, I love it. And it's the best thing that could have happened to me. And, you know, you read the book.
Like, what a perspective, right? That, like, this is a man who can have anything. And the simple things in life are still, like, the best parts, you know.
He does. I think he's realized again what he didn't have as a kid and what he craved his entire life that he couldn't have because he was gay. He now has, and it's he kind of is surprised he has it.
Right.
And he doesn't.
He's very appreciative.
He said he still loves performing. He doesn't get tired of performing, and he you don't get the sense on stage that he's tired of performing, but he does still have moments where he throws tantrums on stage. Not a lot, but you can find clips. Just type in Elton John tantrum stage. You can find him. He's had a couple
kind of tantrums, that kind of shit.
But there's, you know, there was one show at a stadium, 60,000 people there, where his voice just gave out. In his book, he actually described it like he had walking pneumonia and he would not cancel the show. And he would not cancel. He said, I hate canceling shows. It's the ticket holders may have like flown in from somewhere.
Yeah.
So even if we reschedule, what are they going to do?
Right.
The production crew already has the stage halfway set up. The band is ready to go. Yep. And especially in Australia, it's not like I can just say, we'll come back in 2 months and make this date up.
Yeah.
Like, you got to play the show.
Yeah. Thousands of people are depending on him, you know?
So he had walking pneumonia and he goes to start this show. And he said he comes off stage. There's not like an intermission, but there's a part where there's like a musical part that plays for Funeral for a Friend. And he goes off stage for a few minutes during that part. And he said his husband is like, you got to end the show. Like, you look bad. You're clearly sick. You cannot go on. He said, I looked at my husband and the crew and I said, play the fucking tape. And he said, so they played the tape. He goes out there. He plays that song. But like two songs later, his voice just gives out. He's got no voice left.
Yeah.
And he had to walk, like a doctor came out on stage and like took his pulse. And the doctor was like, you have to come off stage. And he hated it. He's crying on stage. He's like, that's hugely disappointing to him to have a stadium full of people who want to hear him and he can't play.
Yeah.
I don't get the sense he has like the Roger Waters, I hate the audience type slant. He doesn't.
Yeah, definitely.
He loves the audience.
Yeah.
He really does.
What a strange sort of mixture of personality of, you know, kind of being a little bit of a prima donna who's like, you know, had everything kind of given to him for a significant portion of his life. So he's got like the temper tantrum thing. But at the same time, he's like, you know, a willing slave to the public, basically to his fans and to everybody who depends on him and stuff. He doesn't, you know, fuck around in that respect. Right.
He's one of the most self-aware rock stars I've ever, I've ever known.
Yeah, exactly. That's interesting. That sounds I might read that book just because what a weird personality to have. You know, like the sort of two sides to a coin all at once. Huh.
So
did this book come out recently, or is it decades?
The book
old?
Came out. The book came out right after Rocket Man. He wrote the book during COVID.
Okay.
He was kind of bored during the 2 years off, so he wrote a book.
Okay.
There's a funny part at the end of the book, and I'll kind of wrap it up with this, where he said, again, this the self-awareness is incredible, where he says he was doing a residency in Las Vegas called the Red Piano or something like that, and the graphics on some of the songs were, like, vulgar. like vulgar, like homosexual nudity. Like crowds, people would sometimes walk out because it was so shocking. And he's like, I loved it. I thought it was great. I was so like, I knew we did it right when I saw people walking out. I didn't want this to be sanitized at all.
And this is the current tour?
No, this was like just the residency he did in Vegas for a couple of months.
Oh, okay.
So he said, but he said he had some surgery right before that residency started that caused him to have like no control over his bladder for some time. Oh, so he had to wear like an adult diaper on stage. And he said, there was a part at the end of one of the shows where I stand up and I'm like waving to the crowd, taking my bow, just pissing all over myself.
Oh my God.
And he's laughing. He said, I was laughing on stage thinking, oh man, if these people only knew their rock star God was pissing all over himself right now.
I feel like Jim Morrison's had some of those times too. So it's, you know, who? it comes with the territory to some degree.
Yeah. You know, we've all had those times. We can't. Anyway.
Listen, I would be pissing on a stage for sure if I had to get in front of 60,000 people, period. So him only doing it because of a medical condition, that's pretty good.
No doubt. No doubt.
Well, that's awesome.
I'll let that be the end of it. I mean, at this point, he seems extremely at peace. He seems extremely happy. He is, again, throw on Elton John's greatest hits, and I would dare say you'll know every one of those songs.
Right.
He's a savant of a musician. He has an all-time great songwriting partner that he is still best friends with to this day, which is amazing. Because I look at that and I think, like, man, the songwriting partners that we idolize, they hate each other. Like, Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend, those guys fucking hate each other.
Yeah, this guy is such a business enigma, man. That's crazy.
That is a business relationship, strictly, you know? And with Elton John and Bernie Taupin, they are genuine friends that deeply love each other. That Elton has said, like, he's like the love of my life. He's just not gay. Man. And I find that to be one of the most unique aspects of his career. I don't know of any other songwriting partnership like that. I'm not aware of one anyway.
Yeah. No, man.
Where the songwriter is just in the background. You know, he's not the bass player or something. He's truly in the background and doesn't seek the spotlight at all. So that's it, man. Elton John, get into him. If he comes across your state, go see him. You'd love it. You would very much enjoy the show. I'm sure he's coming to, I don't know, Portland doesn't really have a big stadium, but Seattle does.
It sounds like he might be coming around multiple times, possibly.
No, he's got one more trip around the U.S. playing stadiums, and he has said his last U.S. show is going to be a Dodger Stadium show, which sounds awesome because he has pretty iconic Dodger Stadium show back in the 70s, where he's wearing that sequined Los Angeles Dodgers uniform.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, when I saw him, we saw kids wearing that same sequins Los Angeles Dodgers uniform. My son saw it and he was like, I could have worn that. And I was like, I didn't know they made that. I had no idea.
100%. That's funny.
But it was really, really, really cool. And
that's awesome.
I love the guy. I think the guy's great. The music is great, but I really love the story. I think it's a really interesting, fun story.
Did you like him before you saw the show a whole bunch, like the records, or is it like you read the bio and that really got you into him?
I've always had some songs that I really love. I've always really loved Funeral for a Friend. I've always really loved Someone Saved My Life Tonight.
Yeah.
I've always liked all the other stuff. I saw him in concert 15 years ago. It's a good show. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But I think seeing YouTube clips of that show and the stage and the whole production, I got way more interested in it. And then reading the book, I was like, that's it. We got to see him. We got to go see him. So
that's awesome. Somebody likes the greatest hits. What record, what's the deep cut that you're going to recommend? Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, or?
I would go Madman Across the Water. Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, I think is not a deep cut, certainly. Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, you can put on, listen to start to finish, and you'll probably recognize half the songs.
Yeah.
I'd say Madman Across the Water. The first two songs are really, really well known, but after that, it's a lot of lesser known songs. But man, I think that might be one of my favorite Elton John albums.
Okay.
And I would say there's a song on maybe his first or second album called Where to St. Peter that I love. And it's not a hit. No one's ever heard it. And I love it. Got a cool 70s guitar sound. Really, really, really good song.
Awesome. We'll put that on the playlist with the rest of the podcast. Yeah. Yeah. Cool, man. All right. Elton John. That was awesome, man.
Yeah. See, hey, we got it in just a little over 2 hours. That's a record for us.
Yep. We'll see you guys later. Bye.
All right, man. Thanks.